It was the whole of the prince's kingdom, laid out as far as the eye could see. Then he looked to the east and stiffened. "You must forgive me for not telling you about this," the prince said. Sharis could feel the prince's eyes on his face, drinking in his reaction. "Admiral Al-Khalil scorns the landed military, and I generally try to keep him appeased. But the time has come for you to know." Ships, Sharis thought in a daze. From their vantage, he could see the eastern port, which opened to the narrow sea and allowed Gujara to trade down the continental coast as far as Kiswa. The port was full of ships, war ships, crowding in to reach the loading docks. Beyond that, he could see the expanse of the narrow sea spreading from Gujara's coast all the way to the horizon. And there he saw more ships, neatly anchored rows of them. Hundreds of them. They dotted the water like a pox. "The shipbuilding 5 years ago on the Sea of Glory," Sharis whispered. "The provisioning levies for more troops than we actually have." "Indeed," Sharis heard pride in the prince's voice. "With aid from our allies, these ships have all made the long journey round the northern continent, through oceans of floating ice and other hazards too fantastic to name. We lost many, but more survived. And now nearly every one has arrived with a bellyful of fierce barbarian warriors. The Kisawati will be most surprised." Sharis struggled to make his mouth work. "When?" "They set sail tomorrow. I'm having their resupply rushed as much as possible. Al-Khalil assures me they can make the Iete Straits in a single day, and be at Kiswa's northeastern coast in an 8-day, or perhaps a few days beyond. Much earlier than I'd intended, of course, thanks to Nias and Kinja, and lovely, treacherous Sunandi. And I'd meant to have 20,000 troops instead of just 10. The rest won't arrive for weeks or months, but 10 should be sufficient for the first wave. Kiswa isn't ready either, after all." Sharis turned to stare at him, too stunned to censor himself as he normally did. "You really intend to do it? Kiswa is twice our size, but we have twice the wealth. And Kiswa's isolationism has earned her enemies among the northern tribes, who resent the way Kiswa hoards trade to the south. The northerners became eager to fight once I promised them control of that trade." The prince smiled, turning to gaze eastward. "Though I'm not sure I'll hold to that agreement. All of their troops are going to die, after all. It will be Gujara's swords which ultimately subdue the Kiswati beast." "Going to die?" Sharis blurted it, trying to think through the numbness of his thoughts. "War. On such a scale, war to engulf the whole eastern half of the continent and the northlands as well. Only an 8-day away." "Of course. Our mad friend has developed even faster than I expected, which is fortunate, as my hand's been forced early. Everything hinges on the Reaper." And then suddenly, Sharis knew what the prince was going to do. He must have gasped, because the prince gave him a sharp look, then smiled at his horror. "Dreamblood," said the prince. He clapped Sharis on the shoulder, companionably. "In the end, it all comes down to that. No longer will my lineage be slave to the Hedwa, and no longer will Gujara be a mere crossroads for trade. We can become the center of a civilization that spans continents, bringing peace and prosperity to all. And I shall give the people a living god, one of flesh and not mere dreams to worship. Do you understand?" Sharis did, and for an eternal instant as he stood there, Nias's treachery paled before his own hunger to draw his sword and strike the prince down. But then the urge passed. He was Xin'ha, a true son of Gujara, and the prince was the avatar of Hananja. To attack him was more than treason. It was blasphemy, And so he knelt, raising his arms in proper manuflection. "I understand, my prince," he said. "My life is yours."
"As it always has been," said the prince.
He turned back then to admire the view. Chapter 29. Those who honor Hananja are expected to obey her law. However, those who dwell in the lands of unbelievers are permitted to conceal their faith as needed to preserve peace. Law. Kisawa. The capital city seemed as unending as the ocean. It was easy to see the shared history with Gujara in Kisawa's sun-baked white walls and narrow brick-paved streets, but there the resemblance ended. There were also great sprawling edifices, some 4 or 5 stories high. There were gold-leaf lintels, brightly colored tile inlays, and sturdy, locked, ornately carved dark wood doors. Vines grew wild over most of the buildings, their flowers scenting the warm, humid air with perfumes so heavy that Najiri could breathe them blocks away. With the scents mingled strange sounds, raucous laughter and furious arguments, the calls of merchants hawking their wares, lullabies and love songs long since forgotten in Gujara. He could taste the city's 3,000 years on his tongue, rich and thick as an elder's dreams. Behind him in the curtained chamber, Ehru slept. He had not spoken since the incident in the desert. He acted only when Najiri guided him. His eyes tracked nothing, lost in some other realm. On the way into the city, Najiri had been able to keep Ehuru's condition hidden from the soldiers, though he suspected Sunandi had noticed. She'd made no protest when he insisted upon sharing quarters with Ehuru, even though her house was large enough to have many guest chambers. The servants had brought food and fresh clothing, then left them undisturbed, giving Najiri the time and privacy to bathe Ehuru and attend to his own toilette. So at sunset, Najiri had knelt on the balcony to pray and seek peace within himself. He meditated until the dreamer rose fully, its four-hued light a comforting and familiar companion. Finally, he went into the guest chamber's bedroom. Ehuru lay amid the translucent hangings, restless despite Najiri's dragonfly Jangisa on his forehead. Najiri parted the hangings and sat down beside him, reaching up to remove the Jangisa. With his fingertips, he traced the frown etched into his mentor's brow. It seemed there was no peace for Hananja's favorite, even in sleep. There was only one way Ehuru would have peace ever again. Najiri shifted his hand to lay a finger on each of Ehuru's eyelids. Ehuru had failed the Pranje's test. To gather him now would be a kindness, far kinder than letting him wake to face the enormity of his crime. It was Najiri's duty as Ehuru's apprentice, his duty as a servant of Hananja. In the Hedua, Ehuru would have been sent onward already, and yet Najiri's hand trembled. In the Hedua, Ehuru would not have faced the test in the midst of a battle, surrounded by chaos and enemies. How could the test truly measure his control under such circumstances? Even Najiri had killed. Not with narcomancy, but murder was murder. And because of that, because he had been off protecting a tithe-bearer in abeyance and not attending Ehuru as he should have done, Ehuru had faced his moment of greatest trial with no one to help him. The failure was as much Najiri's as his. "Brother," he snatched his hand away, overwhelmed by an anguish so intense that its weight seemed to crush him. Pressing his forehead to Ehuru's, he wept helplessly, great racking sobs that echoed throughout the guest chamber and probably beyond. But he was past caring what Sunandi or her servants thought of his grief. He wanted only for Ehuru to wake and shush him and hold him, as he had on that long-ago day when they'd first met. "I would die for you," he had thought on that day, and instead he had learned to kill, to walk in dreams, to dance his soul's joy. He had done it all to make himself worthy of this man, who was the closest thing to a father he had ever known, the closest thing to a lover he had ever wanted. There were no words for what Ehuru was to him. Even Sister Meliatua had not fully grasped it. God, perhaps. Far more than Hananja had ever been. The tears spent themselves after a time. As the tightness in his throat loosened, he pushed himself up, taking deep breaths to try and regain control. Twin streaks of wetness painted Ehuru's face. Najiri brushed them away, and then did the same to himself. All the hard-won peace he'd achieved during the evening's meditation was gone. Sighing, Najiri got to his feet and rubbed a hand over his hair, turning to pace, and stopping as he saw the silhouette in the doorway. Sunandi. She walked in without asking to enter, her bare feet making no noise on the woven grass mats, the moonlight illuminating her face in flashes as she passed near the windows. Though she had probably heard his weeping, she made no mention of it, not looking at him as she passed. He was too weary to feel grateful. When she reached the foot of the bed, she stopped, gazing down at Ehuru for a long moment. Will he die? Once upon a time, Najiri would have hated her for that question. Now he only looked away. Yes. When? When I do my duty. Must it be now? He deliberately took a man's dream blood and gave no peace in return. By our laws, there's no higher crime. She sighed, folding her arms. He sleeps well for a criminal. A minor sleep spell. If he were himself, I'd never have been able to cast it on him. He looked down at the jangisa in his hands, turning it by its fragile-seeming wings. It had been owned by countless gatherers down through the centuries, and before that, the stone from which it had been hewn had flown through the sky, spinning among the gods themselves. Perhaps it had even touched the dreaming moon before falling to earth as magic made solid. Deprivation has greatly weakened his umblike, he said softly, the tether that binds a soul to its body and to the waking world. And now that he is no longer deprived? Under ordinary circumstances, with time, the tether could heal. She threw him a sidelong glance. He will have no time if you gather him. Najiri shook his head. In the Hedawa, he might have managed it, over months in isolation. Out here, amid all this madness, Najiri gestured toward the balcony, Kiswa, the world. No, even leaving aside the matter of his crime, it's hopeless. He felt her eyes on him as he went to the balcony door and leaned against it, gazing out at the city and wishing it were Gujara. Wishing, too, that the Kisawari woman would leave. He had so little time left with Ehuru, but she said nothing for so long that he finally turned back to see if she was there, and stiffened, for she had dared to sit on Ehuru's bed, stroking the fuzz of his unshorn hair with one hand. She glanced up, saw his anger, and smiled. Forgive my familiarity. He reminds me of someone I once knew and loved dearly. She took her hand away. He should have the choice. What? The choice. Of whether to die, when to die. I could accept the terrible things your kind do if you did them only to the willing. Najiri scowled. You believe he is unwilling? A gatherer of Hananja? She winced. Perhaps he is willing. Still, his city prepares itself in secret for war. His brother schemes to use evil magic. A reaper stalks the shadows, and he will live to see none of it resolved. That seems crueler than merely killing him outright. Najiri's hand clenched on the curtain. You only want him with us when we stand before the protectors tomorrow. That I cannot deny. but that serves you as well, for it will help me save both your city and mine. Whatever you might believe, I have no desire to see war between our lands. And too, it pains me to see the two of you suffering like this." Nijiri made a sound of disbelief, but she ignored him, still gazing at Eiru. "When he told me about Lin, I hated all your kind, everyone who uses magic. Now I begin to see that it is your Hetewa that is wicked, and not you." He opened his mouth to curse her blasphemy, then recalled the look in the superior's eyes when they'd taken Eiru away in a rogue's yoke. "Not all the Hetewa. Oh, that was weak. True. You and your mentor, and even the Reaper who took my Lin, you are the victims here, the most pitiful victims of all. Because you believe." Nijiri stared at her, then finally sat down on a nearby chair. He rubbed his face with his hands. "Maybe you're right." She fell silent, perhaps out of surprise at his agreement, perhaps just respectful of his pain. When she spoke again, she kept her voice soft, the way a gatherer would. "Let him live until tomorrow. Let him hear what the protectors have to say. I don't know what sort of information they can give him, but by speaking with them, he could help to seal the breach between my land and yours. Perhaps that will give him some extra measure of peace before—" She hesitated, groping for some delicate way to say it. "Before he dies," Nijiri finished for her. He looked her in the eye and offered a bleak smile. "Death does not trouble us, remember." He focused on Eiru and sobered. "He will not be pleased with me when he wakes." "Endure it," she said, getting to her feet. "Your kind make decisions about other people's lives and deaths all the time, do you not? Perhaps it's time one of you learned to face the consequences of such decisions, instead of simply killing those who object." It was another insult, but there was a note of kindness underlying the acerbity, and he saw in her eyes that this was as near as she could come to a peace offering. He nodded to her. There was no anger left in him now, only grief. "Perhaps it is, Speaker." He saw her eyebrows rise at his use of her proper title. After a long moment, she returned the nod. "Rest well, then, little killer. In the morning, the protectors will see us. Be ready." She turned and walked out, leaving Nijiri alone with Eiru and his thoughts. After a few moments of silence, Nijiri pushed himself up from the chair. Crossing the chamber to Eiru's bedside, he lifted the covers and climbed in, nestling himself into the crook of his mentor's shoulder. Lulled by the steady beat of Eiru's heart, he slept for the rest of the night, not quite at peace, but blessedly without dreams. Chapter 30. All who give of themselves to the Hetewa are entitled to its care and comfort. Law. Eiru opened his eyes to the first hint of dawn's light. "I am still alive," he thought, and despaired. At his side, Nijiri murmured in his sleep. There were dried tear streaks on the boy's face, Eiru noted, and spots on his own chest as well. That drove back some of the anguish, for it was selfish of him to forget that his death was also Najiri's test. Sighing, he wiped the streaks from Najiri's face. "Forgive me," he whispered, and the boy sighed in response. The empty ache inside him was gone, filled by the dead soldier's dream blood. Yet he felt none of the usual peace or satisfaction that should have come after a gathering. Which was no surprise, since what he had done to the soldier could in no way be called gathering. He closed his eyes and saw again the soldier's face, angry at first, then terrified as he realized Eiru's intent. He remembered the feel of the man's soul as it struggled to escape his hunger, as ineffectual as a moth
fluttering in hand, and that, too, had fired Ehuru's lust. Even now he shivered to recall his excitement when he destroyed that soul, to be rewarded by a dizzying spiral of pleasure, whose peak had been more exquisite than anything he had ever experienced in his life. Mere gathering paled beside it, and that was the proof of his irredeemable corruption. He had taken no such pleasure in killing Charleron of Wenkin's clan. In his heart he laughed, humorlessly and bitterly, at his earlier conceit. Had he believed himself too soiled to serve Hananja then, what must she think of the suppurating filth he had become now? The thought left him too anguished even to weep. "Brother?" He opened his eyes and saw that Nijiri had woken. The boy's voice was hoarse, his face puffy. "Are you with me again?" "Yes." He fixed his eyes on the mosaic ceiling, unable to meet his apprentice's gaze directly. Why had the superior ever made him the boy's mentor? He had never been fit for such a responsibility. But Nijiri lowered his eyes, and abruptly Ehuru realized the boy blamed himself for what had happened. "I would have done my duty last night, brother, but I thought, today, the protectors..." He faltered again, then took a deep breath and visibly reached for calm. "I thought perhaps you would want to see at least that part of it through." "Few dying people have the chance to resolve their affairs," Ehuru said, keeping his tone neutral. "Gatherers should receive no special privileges in that respect." "I know that." The boy's voice hardened suddenly, and Ehuru looked at him in surprise. There was a taut, desperate sort of determination on his face. The determination of someone who knew he was doing wrong, yet did it anyhow. "But I can't fulfill the charge of our brothers without your help. I can't unravel so many secrets, and I can't find and destroy the Reaper. Not alone. I'm only an apprentice, Ehuru, brother. You can't ask so much of me." And Ehuru sighed, for he knew Nijiri was right. "Then I shall return with you to Gajara," he said at last, and shook his head at the wild flare of hope in the boy's eyes. "Only that much, Nijiri. In Gujara, Santayi and Rabana can aid you in tracking down the Reaper and cleansing the Hedawa. Once you take my tithe..." Najiri's face fell. Ehuru continued ruthlessly. "You will be a gatherer in full, then. Together the three of you will have the strength to do what must be done." The boy bowed over his hands, trembling. After several long seconds, he lifted his head, composed, though Ehuru suspected it was just a veneer over utter peacelessness. That was a start, he supposed. "Yes, brother," Nijiri said, his every word a grating resistance masquerading as calm. "I shall do as you ask." Ehuru let out a slow breath. Pushing himself to sit up, he swung his legs over the edge of the bed and... an eye of light in the darkness, glaring and gloating as he shivered in a cage and begged Hananja for death. He froze. "Brother?" A vision. He was full of dream blood, more than usual since he'd given no sharer the surplus, and yet his soul still wandered. "Brother?" There was fear in Najiri's voice now. "I share it, my apprentice." How long before the madness claimed him again? An 8 day? Less? How long before the hunger returned, this time insatiable? His blood chilled still further as he recalled what he'd done during the battle. He had put an awake, actively resisting man to sleep without a Jungisa. He had torn the dream blood from that man's mind in mere breaths. Those were not the powers of a gatherer. How long before he became no different from the monster that had attacked Nijiri? "Promise me you will do it, Nijiri," he whispered. His voice sounded hollow to his own ears. "Promise me you'll send me to her while I am still Ensha." He had given his soul name to the boy only once, 10 years ago. But of course Najiri remembered it. From the corner of his eye, he saw the boy inhale. Then after a moment, Najiri said, sincerely now, "I swear it, brother," and he put his hand on Ehiru's. "To show that he doesn't fear me. Oh, but you shall, my apprentice. All shall fear me in the end if you fail. Your comfort is hollow." Oh, but how weak he was, that he craved it anyhow. Ehiru turned his hand up, lacing their fingers together, and they sat this way in silence until Sanandi's servants came to fetch them. The meeting house of the protectors lay at the center of Kiswa's capital. It was an unassuming building, squat and wide, with walls of dusty brown stone and none of Yanya Eon's splendor. For all that, it housed the rulers of a land. Small, unadorned pylons framed its wide entrance. The floors were marble, but unpolished, worn dark with age. The people who stood on its steps, supplicants and influence peddlers, he guessed, many of whom reeked of corruption, watched as Ehiru's party passed. Most were richly dressed and quiet, their eyes reflecting mingled suspicion and awe. And they marked him for what he was at once, though both he and Najiri wore hoodless off-white robes that were the closest Sunandi had been able to come to gatherer daywear. Mindful of Sunandi's property, they had not torn off the sleeves. No one could see their tattoos, but somehow they knew. Yet the austerity of the setting gave Ehiru comfort as he entered the house, behind Sunandi and with Najiri at his side. There was a feeling to the simple architecture and the solemnity of the people he saw inside, true wielders of power and responsibility, perhaps, not mere aspirants, that reminded him of the Hedwa and Gujara. Under other and better circumstances, he might have felt at home. They passed through a dim archway and entered the house itself, a vaulted chamber lit by lattice-covered openings near the ceiling. Dust-flecked sunlight illuminated a curving stone table that stretched from one end of the house to the other. Ehiru counted 17 people seated at this table, all of them elders, and all with the look of nobility, though caste was difficult to tell, here in this land where mingling with foreigners was frowned upon. A handful of attendants lingered amid the pillars behind the protectors. Guards stood on either side of the chamber, watching Ehiru with open suspicion. Otherwise, the chamber was empty of all save the protectors and the three of them. Sunandi stopped in the space before the table and offered an elaborate bow before speaking in formal Sua. "Esteemed and wise, I come before you again in greetings. I am your voice and eyes and ears in foreign lands, and I beg you hear me now on a matter of great urgency." The central figure, an ancient woman with thinning hair in twists, waved her hand. "We have read your initial report, Speaker J. Kalawe, and that of the captain whose troop rescued you in the neutral lands." Sunandi straightened and assumed a less formal manner, though she still kept her eyes respectfully low. "Have you also read the report of Kinja Se Klabsha?" "We have read your account of it, yes." "We would have preferred to see the original from Kinja's own hand, Speaker." She gave Sunandi a stern look. "My protege Lin died trying to bring that document to you, esteemed." She paused for only a moment, though Ehiru saw the concealed flicker of anger in her eyes. "I was unable to recover it from her remains." "We are sorry for the loss of your slave, J. Kalawe," said another of the protectors, though he did not sound sorry to Ehiru's ears. The man's casual dismissal of the North-blooded girl was offensive, but it explained much of Sanandi's defensiveness about her. "You may request compensation after this audience, but I will admit to having some concerns about your report." He narrowed his eyes at her, then cast a disdainful look at Najiri. I have more significant concerns about your bringing these outlanders here, whoever they are.
Sanandi squared her shoulders. They are gatherers of Gujara, esteemed. The Hananjan priest Ahiru, and his apprentice, Najiri. I have brought them here on their request. They too seek the counsel of the protectors. There were murmurs of surprise at this, and several of the protectors whispered quickly to one another. Finally, the woman in the middle said, I cannot imagine what Gujara's unholy priests would want of us.
Information, honored elder, Ahiru said in formal Sua, his voice prompting another stir among the protectors. He saw Sunandi glance at him in consternation, as he violated some sort of protocol, but he did not care. He had too little time left to waste on propriety. Many disturbing events have occurred in my land of late, he said. A reaper walks the streets of the capital, unchecked, and perhaps abetted by those in power. 20 men, he glanced at Sunandi, 20 men and the speaker's girl are known to have died at its hands. I have been blamed for the reaper's attacks, yet freed on the condition that I gather Speaker J. Kalawe. And now your own soldiers have encountered Gujarin troops in the Empty Thousand, again trying to kill the speaker. I want to know why so many of my countrymen want this woman dead.
The old woman raised both eyebrows into her faded hairline. You believe we know?
He inclined his head to her.
I believe there must be a reason the prince corrupts himself and risks war with Kiswa to conceal the secrets this woman carries. I believe there is a reason the Hedawa aids him and allows the Reaper to exist. And I believe, though I have nothing but my instincts for proof, that all these things are somehow connected. No one in my land who knows the truth can be trusted. Perhaps outlanders are the answer.
There was another susurrus in the chamber as the protectors whispered among themselves. Sanandi threw Ahiru a sidelong glance.
You are a greater madman than I thought, she murmured in Gujarin. He nodded, unamused. Very soon it would be true.
Presently the protectors concluded their discussion.
Very well, gatherer of Gujara, said the old woman. Half the things we have heard from our spies lately are so incredible we hardly know what to make of them. Perhaps an exchange of information will give us answers as well. Then she glanced at one of the other protectors, who scowled mightily before finally sighing.
I must caution you that our information is incomplete, the man said. But it begins several years ago, when our Shadoon allies found a tomb in the western desert foothills, far off the usual trails. They found it because it had been recently disturbed, robbed. The robbers fled north, toward Gujara. We did not think this important at first, though of course we had the matter investigated. We now believe the tomb was that of Inanru, first gatherer and founder of your faith.
Najiri frowned in confusion and blurted, But his tomb was lost centuries ago, and would be sacred to us now. Why would any Gujarin desecrate?
Sanandi threw him a glare, and he subsided immediately. Your apprentice speaks true, gatherer, if out of turn, the old man said, giving Najiri an equally quelling eye, before focusing on Ahiru again. It is good to know that you at least preserve a proper reverence for the history of your faith, if not the proper manner of worship.
Ahiru lifted his chin.
Some might say we preserved both better than Kiswa, honored elder. Magic was once used here, too. The old man gave him a sour glare. That was before we realized the horror of such power.
Perhaps, but what has that to do with the present matter?
We did not know, until last night when we read Kinja's report as delivered to us by J. Kalawe. The old man sighed. Many centuries ago, here in Kiswa, the first priests who dabbled in dream magic began to go mad, or so our own lore says. Inanru, who too was at risk,
study them in hope of determining the cause and cure. A century later, when magic was banned and his followers banished, most of Inanru's records were destroyed, lest the knowledge they contained linger and flourish again, like a pestilence. The old man's lip curled. But there have always been tales that some of Inanru's followers managed to smuggle several scrolls out of the city. "We always believed," said the old woman, "that the scrolls were in Gujara. But apparently they were lost to your people as well. Until lately." She looked at Sunandi, her expression bleak. Sunandi nodded slowly. "I saw a locked case in the prince's quarters. That is where he keeps them, I believe." "Hmm." The old woman looked weary, as if she had not been sleeping well. An overabundance of dream bile, a part of Ehru's mind catalogued, while the rest of him listened, as numbed as if by a sleep spell. "Yes, it was the prince's men who raided the tomb, or so we believe. All this madness began after that." Sunandi took a deep breath. "And it explains many other things, esteemed." She looked at Ehru, though she continued speaking to them. "My mentor Kinja long suspected that the prince planned a war. His contacts warned him of the prince's negotiations with several northern tribes to forge a military alliance, and there had been a spate of unusual imports, heavy wood and iron, northern shipbuilding artisans and the like, though all that trickled off a few years ago. But several months ago, Kinja also learned that the prince had deliberately created a reaper. He controls the creature using secret knowledge, doubtless from the stolen scrolls. The creature was used as an assassin, killing all who might interfere with the prince's plans. The deaths resembled natural causes. Kinja himself may have..." Here she faltered for just a moment, visibly fighting emotion. "In Gujara, no one would question such things," Ehru murmured, more to her than to the protectors. He felt fresh pity for her now, hearing that both her mentor and her protégé had died at the Reaper's claws. For that, he tried to comfort her, though only with words, since that was all he had. "No one but gatherers, and we did not know. If we had, we would have helped you." She gave a curt nod, getting control of herself, and faced the protectors again. "Before I left Gujara, I also learned that the creature has been involved in a number of incidents at the capital's prison. Many prisoners have died, in ways which puzzle even the Gujarine, for these are young, healthy men who slip away in their sleep, ungently. So it would seem the prince is not content to use his reaper as merely a convenient assassin. He nurtures the creature's evil, helping its powers to grow for reasons known only to himself." She hesitated, glancing at Ehru. "What I could not be certain of was the Hetawa's involvement. And thus she dared not trust him with everything she knew." He heard the apology in her voice, and nodded acceptance, though he marveled at it given her hatred of his kind. But somehow, over the course of recent days, her feelings toward gatherers, no, toward Ehru, had apparently changed. There was a degree of respect in her manner now, which he had never expected to see. He glanced toward Najiri and saw grudging compassion in the way he looked at Sunandi. Change on both sides, then. Good. "And Kinja learned, though Jay Kalawe was the one to bring us this knowledge," said the old woman, with an approving glance at Sunandi, "that for the past 5 years, since the prince found the scrolls, Gujara has been quietly building its fleet of ships to levels useful only for war. Other spies have confirmed this. Shipyards outside the city, along the Sea of Glory, have been producing vessels in great quantity. We do not watch the Sea of Glory closely. It has no connection to the Eastern Ocean, and so poses no threat to Kiswa, or so we believed. but we now know those ships were designed with thicker hulls than are needed on the sea, built using techniques borrowed from the northern tribes. Therefore, we suspect the prince now has a fleet of ships which can sail all the way around the northern continent, through the frozen and dangerous waters at the top of the world, to reach the eastern seas. She paused. We suspect the prince has sent these ships forth already, most of them years ago. Each left its dock as soon as it was completed, never more than one at a time. But by the volume of materials involved and the guesses of our own shipmasters, we estimate some 500 ships could have begun the northern journey by now. She heaved a long sigh. Your prince is as patient as an elder. The Kiswati woman. She cannot be permitted to reach Kiswa, Ehru, or there will be war. Aninket's words echoed in Ehru's mind, and he shivered at the enormity of his brother's misdirection. War had already been declared. Only its timing made any difference. Yes, Ehru said. He was angry again, too angry, another mark of his corruption. He controlled it with an effort. Patience is only one of the gifts our goddess bestowed upon him. I hadn't realized until now just how thoroughly he has misused those gifts. A hint of compassion seemed to flicker in the old woman's eyes for a moment. Then perhaps you will oblige us by sharing information of your own, she said. As I told you, we suspect the prince has forged secret agreements with several of the far northern tribes for military alliance, and for safe passage through their waters. These agreements have been primarily brokered through a Bromarte trader clan. A minor member of this clan, a Bromarte named Charleron of Wenking's clan, was one of Kinja Sekalabja's contacts. He recently died. Jekalawe has heard rumors that he was gathered, or perhaps reaped. Do you know anything of this? Goddess, forgive me. This madness goes so much deeper than I ever suspected. Ehru closed his eyes and took a long, slow breath. I was the one who collected his tithe. The protectors began to murmur again, though the old woman shushed them quickly. Who commanded his death? The prince? His own kinsmen? Did he give you any information before he died about strife between the prince and your superior? These things I do not know, Ehru replied. The commission came in the usual manner. I was told he had an incurable disease. I had no reason to suspect anything unusual. But even as he said this, he remembered the Bromarte's words in the dream. They're using you. And too, he remembered the silhouette that had been watching from a nearby rooftop. If I had not killed him, the Reaper would have. He shuddered as understanding came at last, too late, and tinged with a bitter irony. The old woman looked at her fellow protectors. The Bromarte clans are reluctant members of the Alliance, thanks to their long ties with both Gujara and Kiswa. They have stayed as neutral as possible, only brokering deals with other clans that are more willing to fight, like the Sereni. But some of them, like Charleron, were willing to warn us of the danger. No troops have left Gujara, another man mused, picking at a spot on the table. Their armies are at full strength, deployed a bit closer to the border than usual, but they haven't begun to move. Of that much we can be certain. Another man said, the Fiend and the Sereni have ports along the Eastern Ocean, and they have ties to tribes with ports even along the frozen northern seas and the windswept. Gujara has great wealth. They can afford to pay others to fight their wars. So if the prince's vessels were empty, so that they could travel faster, and if they could be filled with northern warriors after making the ocean journey... Silence fell in the chamber. In it, Sunandi cleared her throat. Respectfully, esteemed, are our warriors prepared for an attack? An old woman at the far end of the table leveled a hard look at Sunandi. We have been doing nothing else since we first learned of Gujara's warship fleet, Speaker. But even so, The prince has moved more cleverly than expected, said the woman at the center.
She spoke heavily, oblivious to the quelling looks of her fellow counselors. After a long moment, she lifted her head.
I thank you for your report, Jekyllawe, and gatherers of Gujara.
Sunandi offered her bow again, but as she straightened, she hesitated, esteemed and wise. Kiswa has not had war for many centuries, and never with her daughter nation of Gujara. Is there no hope remaining for peace?
That is up to the prince, the central woman said. We shall of course attempt to parley with him, said another of her companions, though it seems unlikely he will be interested in peace after investing this much in his attack.
The central woman sighed, shaking her head.
And what will you do, gatherer Ehiru?
Return to Gujara, Ehiru replied. There is still the matter of the Reaper, since it seems you have uncovered no information about its connection to all this. But as for the rest, my brothers must know of the prince's plans. There are still some in the Hedewa whom I trust, and who will help me try to stop this, if it can be stopped. War is the greatest possible offense to Hananja. The old woman considered this for a moment. You may have horses and provisions to facilitate your journey home. But take care. By coming here, you may have made yourselves an enemy of your lord.
He bowed over one hand to her. We serve Hananja, elder. Our prince is merely her avatar, and as such he rules only on her sufferance.
As he straightened, he remembered Aninket's face at their last meeting, smiling, reassuring, lying through his teeth. The rage returned, not the red, brutal rage he'd been fighting since the desert, but something cleaner and more welcome. The cold and righteous anger of a servant of Hananja. Perhaps I am not wholly corrupt yet, he decided. Perhaps I can remain myself long enough to administer justice one last time. And for you, my birth brother, that justice is long overdue.
Seeing something of Ehiru's thoughts in his face, the old woman's eyes widened. But then her fear faded, and she returned a slow, grim nod.
Then I bid you good luck, gatherer, she said. And for all our sakes, good hunting.
Chapter 31 The Hedewa shall offer healing to all, Gujarin and foreigner alike, believer and unbeliever. The goddess welcomes all who dream. Law.
Najiri heard the crowd before they walked out of the meeting house. At first he thought it was the river, though he had already seen as they passed through the city that the river curved away to the west, disappearing into the green, mist-covered mountains in the distance. Then his ears sifted out words and phrases and shouts, and he realized the noise was voices. So many of them, raised and speaking at once that the result was a monotonous roar. He could not imagine why so many people would assemble in such undisciplined chaos. No public gathering in Gujara was ever so loud. Was it perhaps a riot? He had heard of such things in foreign lands. Then he stepped outside and saw people, hundreds of them, possibly thousands, thronging the steps of the meeting house and the streets and the alleys beyond it, men and women and children and elders, so many that he could not see the end of them. But when he and Ehiru emerged onto the steps of the house with Sunandi, the gaggle softened, then went silent altogether. Sunandi and Ehiru stopped, and Najiri did as well, all three finding themselves the focus of countless pairs of eyes. Breaths passed. Najiri looked into the faces of the nearer crowd members and saw many things, from fear and curiosity to anger and adoration. More than anything else, he saw something that shocked and confused him, for though he had seen it many times in Gujara, he'd never expected to see it in a city that named gatherers anathema. Hope. But what they wanted from Ehiru,
Only Ehuru, no one seemed even to notice Nijiri. He could not guess.
Then Ehuru stepped forward, turning his hands, palms open at his sides. Startled, Nijiri hastened to follow, hearing Sunandi mutter something under her breath, then follow as well. When he glanced at Ehuru's face, he was stunned again, for the strain and misery of the past month had vanished from his brother's face. He was smiling, in fact, as he continued forward into the crowd, and his expression was the one Nijiri remembered from their first meeting years and years ago. Tenderness, sternness, warmth, detachment, peace. The crowd, seeing this, murmured and parted for him, whispering to one another. Then behind them Nijiri heard boots and the jangle of armor, jarring the aura of peace. He glanced around and saw that several protectorate guardsmen had come out onto the steps, whispering anxiously to one another at the sight of the crowd. Nijiri dismissed them from his attention and focused on Ehuru instead, for he felt certain that what he was witnessing was no less than an intervention of the goddess. Kiswa had abandoned narcomancy centuries before, but respect for it and faith in Hananja's power clearly still lingered in at least some small part of her ancient soul. As Ehuru's apprentice, it was his duty to bear witness to such a momentous event. "I do so with a glad heart. Hananja, thank you for making my brother himself again, if only for this moment." Then someone pushed forward from the crowd, half dragging another figure. Ehuru stopped. Nijiri tensed, but it was only a man pulling a child along with him. A child, he realized in belated horror, who had been afflicted with some terrible, crippling wrong at some point in his short life. The boy's head lolled back on his shoulders, as if he lacked the strength or control to raise it, and though his legs seemed to function, they did so poorly, lurching and wavering to such an unsteady degree that without the man's aid he might have fallen. Worst of all, Nijiri saw that both his arms had withered, becoming tiny and useless beneath the elbow. "Gatherer, your pardon," said the man. He wore the garb of a blacksmith, and spoke such a thick dialect of Sua that Nijiri barely understood him. "My son, this is my son. Will you heal him? Take my life if it will help, Gatherer. I am a loyal follower of Hananja. The healers here can do nothing for him. Please." As if those words had been a signal, other voices suddenly rose around them. "My mother, Gatherer, she's dying," called a woman, and another woman's husband, and a soldier pointed to his missing eye, and a stooped elder begged to be sent to his wife in Inikarek so that he would no longer be alone. So many, all of them, so hungry, pressing forward and extending hands in supplication. They even began to look at Nijiri, fingers plucked at his shoulders, at his robe. Someone caressed the back of his head and he started away, catching a glimpse of desperate yearning in a woman's eyes before the crowd surged forward again and she was lost in it. Abruptly, there were too many hands, too many pleading voices all around them, wanting, needing, desperate for more than any two gatherers, any ten gatherers could ever provide. Nijiri gasped as someone yanked at his robe, tearing it. On pure instinct, he struck back, knocking the hand away and shifting into a guard stance. Someone grabbed at Sunandi too, and Nijiri caught a glimpse of Sunandi's eyes widening in alarm as she pulled away. "Let me see your son," Ehuru said to the first man who had spoken. His voice cut across the rising din, though he had not raised it. The crowd still hushed and drew back. In the new silence, Ehuru stepped forward and took the child's chin in his fingers, pulling the lolling head upright to examine unfocused eyes. "He is still himself," the man said. His voice was thick with unshed tears. "The withering sickness came upon him years ago and destroyed his body, but he still has a mind. He is my only child.
I understand, Ehuru said, and sighed. He can be healed, but not by me. Such a healing would require dream seed to regenerate the muscles and nerves, and dream bile to stop any growth that has gone wrong. Surgery could be used to remove the parts of his body damaged beyond reclaim, and that would require dream blood to banish his pain, and dream ichor to replenish his strength. It would take many 8 days, and there is a possibility it would not succeed completely. I have not the skill to do any of it. But you're a gatherer. Ehuru looked up, and the man's protests died on his lips. A gatherer, not a sharer. I can help him in only one way. In the silence, the words carried. The man caught his breath, but instead of drawing back as Najiri expected, he reached out and caught Ehuru's arm in a hard grip. Then help him that way, the man said. My son weeps every night, knowing that he can never inherit our smithy, he can never marry or care for us, his parents. He will be like this the rest of his life. He reaches the age of manhood in 2 years, but his mother still diapers him like a babe. He feels pain with every movement. He has begged me to kill him many times, but I could never... The courage. He shuddered, bowing his head and shaking it fiercely. But if he cannot be healed... Ehuru watched him for a moment, then looked at the boy. A horrible, palsied movement passed through the child's flesh, tears welling in his eyes and spilling down the sides of his face, his mouth gaping open and closed and open again. It took long, painful breaths for Najiri to realize that the twitching, frenzied movement was the child's effort to nod agreement. Oh, goddess, how could you allow such suffering to continue? How could anyone? But though he had expected no answer to that prayer, he got one anyhow, as Sanandi stepped forward and put a hand on Ehuru's other wrist. I cannot permit this, she said. She spoke softly, her face subdued, but she did not take her hand away. Ehuru merely looked at her. Najiri heard gasps from the crowd, however, and when he turned to see what had startled them, he saw two of the guards coming down the steps, spears at the ready. Do it, and they will kill both you and the boy's father, gatherer, she said, raising her voice loud enough for the crowd to hear. Then she looked at the man, sighing. I understand that your son suffers, but what you ask goes against every law we honor. The man stared, then lunged at her, dragging the afflicted child, trying to hit her with his free hand, his face contorted with rage. The crowd cried out in collective alarm. Ehuru caught the man immediately and pulled him and the child back. Najiri stepped in front of Sanandi to protect her. Honor? The man cried. What should I honor? Do you see my son? What does the law do for him, high-caste bitch? Ehuru laid a hand on the man's chest and pushed him firmly back. Peace, he said. And even if Najiri had not sensed the quicksilver flow of dream blood between them, he would have known it by what happened next. The man caught his breath and stumbled backward, clutching his son to himself in reflex. He blinked at them with no hint of his former rage, focusing on Ehuru in stunned wonder. Take your son to the Hedawa in Gujara, Ehuru told him. Then he turned to Sanandi and the guards, his eyes cold with suppressed anger. That much is permitted, is it not? Or is even a gatherer's advice illegal here? She watched him for a long moment, and with a chill Najiri saw that she knew what Ehuru had done to the angry man. How she knew he could not guess. Perhaps it was only that she was skilled at observing others. Regardless, on her word the guards could kill Ehuru for using narcomancy, and in the process free her from the threat of the Abeyance, at least until matters could be settled in Gujara, and another gatherer dispatched to collect her tithe. Bile rose in Najiri's mouth. He clenched his fists. Wicked, filthy-souled woman, he thought at her, willing her to sense his rage. If he dies, another gatherer is right.